It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today on board our Politics Day edition of River to River, two esteemed political scientists. Sarah Mitchell is the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Dennis Goldford, Professor of Politics at Drake University. Dennis and Sarah, welcome to our hour.
Hi there.
Hello.
Sarah, you're there too as well. Wonderful. We invite our listeners during this hour to join our conversation as well. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. A little bit later in the hour, I'll ask Sarah and Dennis's thoughts on the challenge that Democrat Rita Hart is making in the U.S. House to that narrow loss of the Iowa 2nd Congressional District race, just six votes there, that win that has been certified. Also, we'll talk about what will happen when Congress formally counts the votes of the Electoral College. Iowa legislature priorities we'll touch on. Also, President-elect Biden, his transition continues, naming an education secretary, we heard in our news. Now 28 days before President-elect Biden takes the oath of office. But first, let's start off with this. Donald Trump threatening not to sign a nearly $900 billion coronavirus relief measure that includes desperately needed money for Americans. He said it should be amended to increase the amount on the stimulus checks. Trump called the measure a disgrace, demanding changes, including payouts to Americans of $2,000 instead of $600. Interestingly, afterward, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi tweeted, Democrats are ready to bring this to the floor this week by unanimous consent. Let's do it. Even before Donald Trump weighed in, Democrats arguing that more coronavirus relief legislation will need to be enacted early in the incoming Biden administration. Well, let's hear President Trump yesterday criticizing this COVID stimulus bill, again saying payments to families were too low, citing wasteful spending included in the measure, speculating that he'll be the next administration to address the problems in the bill. Let's listen.
I'm asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000 or $4,000 for a couple. I'm also asking Congress to immediately get rid of the wasteful and unnecessary items from this legislation and to send me a suitable bill, or else the next administration will have to deliver a COVID relief package, and maybe that administration will be me.
Okay. Weigh in on this first of all, Dennis. Size up what you see happening and the position that it puts the Republican congressional leaders in.
My first reaction is to wonder where the president's been for the last couple of weeks. He could have been part of this process, indicating his concerns all along as the bill was being fashioned. That said, there is certainly some there are some provisions in here. We used to call these Christmas tree bills, in which legislatures would sort of put quietly all sorts of gifts to favored constituencies and interest groups into a must-pass bill. But I think that you're right. This does really put the Republicans in a bind because, on the one hand, the president really doesn't care about the deficit and balanced budgets and things like that. That's sort of standard Republican boilerplate principle that this president has never particularly cared about, which is why so many of them were concerned about him 4 years ago. But on the other hand, I have to say that politically, this is actually quite clever, whoever thought of this and suggested it to the president. It's a win-win for him, because on the one hand, I've got lots of on the one hands, other hands today, evidently, in the first place, if they go back and increase the amount of the stimulus check, then the president can go to his folks, many if not most of whom would be, at least at that base level, would probably be eligible for these things. He would be the conquering hero, and he would look really good to them because he's increased their stimulus check. If this doesn't succeed, he looks like the valiant defender of their interest against the establishment, be it Republican or Democratic, although it's more Republican in this case. And he comes off looking as if he continues to be relevant to his base. So this right now, at least, could be a win-win for him.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, what do you have to add to what Dennis just said?
Well, I think just a comment first that some of the provisions that Trump is talking about in terms of the wasteful spending that's being added, some of those, like fisheries, are part of the omnibus spending bill, not the COVID package itself. So they're lumping these together for a vote. So I think there's some confusion, right, about what's being talked about in terms of the wasteful spending. Mm-hmm. Second of all, this is politically challenging for the Republican Party. I mean, I think I agree with Dennis that it could be good for Trump, but Mnuchin was the one who proposed the $600 amount, and that was higher than what a lot of members of the Republican caucus wanted. And that's because they wanted to keep the bill under $1 trillion. And so this, if they were to agree to Trump's proposal, this would clearly push the bill well over that $1 trillion mark. And in the Georgia Senate races, Loeffler and Perdue were selling this as a success, right? So to have the president come out and criticize the bill, it's also interesting to think about what are the implications for how it's going to affect the Senate races that are still going on in Georgia.
Yeah, well, Sarah, that's an interesting facet there. The Georgia race is so interesting. If the Democrats can beat these two incumbents, Perdue and Loeffler, they will have the narrowest of majorities in the Senate, with the Vice President, Kamala Harris, being the President of the Senate, or breaking any ties, I guess I should say. This plays in Georgia. This complicates Georgia to the detriment of the Republicans there. Sarah, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because I think a lot of the, like the current Georgia senators, they're part of the sort of deficit part of the Republican Party. And so they were the ones who proposed this lower amount of checks to be sent out and to pull back the aid that wasn't put in the bill for states and local governments. And so for Trump to come out on the other side and to push the bill's costs, up to, much higher levels, you can see the Democrats' leadership is jumping on this, right?
Yeah.
So you've got Pelosi sure. saying, yes, we'll consider this right away.
Yeah, so, and we don't even need to take a vote. Unanimous consent. We don't even need a
exactly.
floor vote, right?
So it tells you where Trump's position is relative to the two parties.
Yeah. Dennis, any ideas, guesses how this will proceed, how this will turn out, when Americans will get this desperately needed stimulus?
I don't know. I mean, the president technically hasn't vetoed it yet. And remember, constitutionally, this is sort of standard Article 1, Section 7 of the Constitution. Once the bill arrives on the president's desk, which supposedly it did Monday night, he has 10 days, excluding Sundays, to sign it or send it back. Or there's the other option, which I'll mention in a moment. And so if he does that, he's got to formally veto it, although it was passed by two veto-proof majorities in the two houses. So technically, they could override that if Republicans were willing to override Mr. Trump. But so he hasn't sent the bill back with a veto message yet. If, of course, he does nothing and Congress technically remains in session, technically has not adjourned, and that gets sticky what all that means, then it could become law without his signing it. That occasionally occurs if a president really doesn't like a bill but doesn't want to make a veto fight over it. Again, that would be 10 days excluding Sundays, which by my calculation roughly is around January 1st. If Congress has formally or is considered to have adjourned, and he just sits on it and doesn't veto it, that's the famous pocket veto. In other words, the bill dies. So in a sense, we're at a, I wouldn't say a standoff, but The question is what the Republicans in the Senate will decide to do with regard to this challenge from the president, and whether, in fact, the president does actually choose to veto this, sending the bill back to the House in which it originated, which I presume was the House.
Yeah. Sarah, to end this part of our conversation, where does this leave the president-elect with this surprise turn of the current president?
Well, I think one of the big problems here is that if there is a veto, either regular or pocket, then this could lead to a government shutdown. It would cut off the extension of unemployment benefits for people in the United States. So the economic implications of this failing are significant at this time of year, especially given how much, you know, if you see their most recent unemployment numbers, right, they're much higher, right, than they should be at this time of year. So a lot of people are out there suffering economically, and if this bill doesn't pass, it's going to get worse. And so I think that leaves Biden and Harris, right, in a tough position coming in, because they have to, instead of taking over with a budget in place, they're going to have to negotiate that on the front end, which is more difficult.
Right. And the shutdown, the optics of not passing this, a shutdown, those optics over the holidays when so many people are in need. Wow. Okay. We'll watch how this develops. If you've just joined us, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, our two political scientists on board this week. Well, let's move on it's a national story, but finds its origins right here in Iowa. Is there a looming partisan showdown in Congress next month over Iowa's second congressional district contest? Now, Democrat Rita Hart fell 6 votes short of winning that open seat against Congresswoman-elect Marionette Miller Meeks. That was out of nearly 400,000 votes cast, just 6 votes difference. Well, yesterday, Hart formally contested her loss with the U.S. House. She's a former state senator, and she filed a 176-page complaint with the House Administration Committee, which will take the lead in investigating her contest. At issue, according to the Hart campaign, 22 ballots that were not included in the initial tally or subsequent recounts, but that Hart's campaign says should have been included. These ballots would give Hart a 9-vote lead and make her the winner of this race, one of the tightest in congressional history. Hart asking for a full recount, citing, in her words, wildly inconsistent counting procedures from county to county. Dennis, start us off. Your thoughts on this challenge by Rita Hart?
Well, the first thing this shows is, of course, that every vote does count, as much as people like to say that it doesn't. You never know. And election officials always, regardless of party and party preference, they always pray for a landslide. So you don't get into a situation like this in which a handful of votes can make a difference. But Hart certainly has the right to do this. Again, going back to constitutional procedure, Article 1, Section 5 famously says, each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members. So Hart has a right to go to the House of Representatives and ask them, the appropriate committee, to take a look at all this and judge who they will accept as the winner of the election. But, of course, there's a procedure here in Iowa as well, contesting presidential congressional elections. They call for what's called a court of contest. And she chose not to do that, presumably because there's a Democratic majority in the House, even if it'll be reduced from what it is now once the new Congress meets as of January 4th. But you've got Miller Meeks saying that certain votes on her that she believes went for her were not counted. You've got Hart listing the votes in various counties that she says weren't counted. So we might get a full recount. One of the arguments was there really wasn't a time to do a proper recount, especially in the more populous counties. So if you're an elected official, this is precisely the sort of situation you absolutely fear and detest.
Right. Democratic leaders will have to decide, according to what I've been seeing, on January 3rd, that's the first day of the 117th Congress, whether to seat Marionette Miller Meeks provisionally or leave that seat open while it investigates. Weigh in here, Sarah. What do you think the Democrats are mulling over here, their position?
Well, just to give some historical context, Jeff Jenkins, who's a political scientist at USC, did a study on all instances of contested House seats from 1789 to 2012. There were 594 of those, so it's maybe more common than we think it is, but not super common, but it does happen. They have declined over time, but only five instances of House. There's only five cases since 1922 where the U.S. House has changed the election outcome, and where they have made those changes, they've voted along partisan lines. So that suggests that, first of all, it's probably unlikely that the House will agree to take on the recount, because if you think, look back since 1985, there have been 15 petitions that have been dismissed. So this, like I said, for the people bringing forward these cases, they're not heard very often. But if they were to agree to the recount, the Jenkins study suggests that the democratically controlled House would be very likely to vote in favor of Hart. So I think it's a long shot for Hart, but given what we've seen in the past, it could go in her favor if they agree to do the recount.
We don't have any audio from Miller Meeks or Hart, but I do have quotes from them. Let me just recite those two quotes and then have you, Dennis, first of all, talk about the arguments each is posing, if they are, in these quotes. I think they are. Hart, Rita Hart, everyone, she says, has acknowledged that there are uncounted votes left. And after reviewing those ballots and making sure they are counted, it will be clear I have won this election. It is crucial to make sure that this bipartisan review by the U.S. House is fair. That was the words of Rita Hart. Marionette Miller Meeks says this election has been decided by Iowans. That decision should not be thrown into Washington's hyper-partisan atmosphere. It is shameful that Rita Hart does not have faith in Iowans and does not respect the decision of Iowa voters. So if we can look past the spin there, Dennis, do you see good arguments on both sides?
Well, you know, there's an old adage, where you stand is based at least somewhat on where you sit. In other words, your principles to some extent have some tendency to reflect what your particular interests are. And I guess the skeptic, if not the cynic in me, suggests that if we had a reverse situation with Miller Meeks behind by six votes and a Republican-controlled House, I wouldn't be surprised at all to see her doing precisely the same thing that Rita Hart's doing. Now, maybe that's not the case, but that would be my guess. I think we have clearly a situation here in which both candidates are saying every vote must count, which, again, that's the principle. Who can oppose that? Every vote must count, certainly. It's just Hart is saying, for her, there she can point to votes that were not counted. Miller Meeks, again, according to certain pieces I've read in various news outlets, if she's saying from this quote, they've all been counted, it's done. But at the same time, she said, no, there were some votes out there for me that didn't get counted. So that seems to be a bit of an inconsistency. You might want to say maybe they should have started with this court of contest in Iowa to try to sort all this out.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the legislature here in Iowa. The 2021 legislative session scheduled to begin January 11th. Your thoughts, Sarah, first on the priorities at the Iowa legislature as this new session starts in the midst of the pandemic. We remember last year the session interrupted early when the coronavirus entered our lives. Republicans in Des Moines continue their control of both chambers and, of course, the governorship. What do you have your eyes on, Sarah, for this coming legislative session?
Well, given that Republicans have strengthened their lead in both chambers, I would expect that the agenda that they lay out is very likely to be successful. So I think they're talking a lot about school vouchers for public schools where individuals can basically be reimbursed for up to $5,000 in costs. As you might imagine, that's controversial from the Democratic side because it would take away up to $50 million in funding for public schools in Iowa. They're also promoting better child care policies, so providing grants and other financial incentives, basically to get more people providing daycare or to relax some of the rules for home care daycare so you could have more individuals in the home. So basically the argument is that there's not enough provision of daycare in certain parts of Iowa. So this is I think this would be a policy that would be supported by both parties because it's an important issue, right, that lots of people face in terms of availability and really skyrocketing costs of childcare. And then so are going to continue their push for improved mental health funding, which I think, again, would find support in both parties.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, your read on the legislature, then we'll take a break after. We have a couple minutes before our break. Dennis, your thoughts on the coming legislative session?
Sure. Really quickly, I'll spare a lot by saying I think Sarah's right in terms of the kinds of priorities she's talking about. To some extent, of course, the concern is how do they manage the budget to deal with these various issues. But the couple of things that particularly catch my eye beyond those particular priorities are, of course, the rumblings we get now about the bottle bill, which has become controversial again, but also in particular two constitutional amendments. The gun amendment requiring strict scrutiny to regulate what kind of legislation can pass that would apply to gun ownership. We to pass a constitutional amendment in Iowa, it's got to pass two consecutive legislative sessions and then go to the voters, two general assemblies. So they passed it once. It will go to the second. Presumably this will come up and then go to the voters in a couple of years. And then I've got it on good authority from the legislature that the abortion amendment from last session is likely to come up again.
Okay. We'll continue this Politics Wednesday edition of our program when we come back. Also, just to mention there, to finish up with the Iowa legislature, we're seeing that the new Iowa Senate Minority Leader calling one of his top priorities for the session to spend state money on pandemic relief. We have thus far only had federal money spent on that. Governor Kim Reynolds and Republican legislative leaders relied almost entirely on money from the federal government to provide some pandemic-related assistance to Iowans. Well, when we come back, let's continue with our discussion going to the more of the aftermath of this presidential race, the next steps in the Electoral College vote. Usually a formality, gains relatively little attention. Not so in this unconventional year with this unconventional president. We'll talk about the Electoral College vote in Congress, how that's counted up when we come back. Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa. Stay tuned. More of River to River Politics Wednesday just ahead. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, our two political scientists on board, as we like to do every Wednesday, picking apart the latest, a select few things on the political landscape. Let's talk about the Electoral College, on to the aftermath of this presidential race. Quite an aftermath it is. The next steps in this Electoral College vote, it's usually a formality, little attention paid to it in most years, most election years. Not so in this unconventional year with this unconventional president. President Trump continuing to claim falsely that he, not Joe Biden, won the November 3rd election. Now, courts in several states have heard the president's claims and have rejected them. In fact, his own attorney general, let's listen to the words of his own attorney general, saying Monday he saw no reason to appoint a special counsel to investigate widespread fraud in the U.S. presidential election.
You know, there are fraud in unfortunately, in most elections. I think we're too tolerant of it, and I'm sure there was fraud in this election. But I was commenting on the extent to which we had looked at suggestions or allegations of systemic or broad-based fraud that would affect the outcome of the election, and I already spoke to that, and I stand by that.
Okay. States have already counted their own electors. Iowa's, of course, included. Biden won with 306 to 232 electoral votes. Now it's up to Congress to vote the count these votes submitted by the states. The next date on the electoral calendar, January 6th. Now, that's when Congress meets in a joint session to count formally the votes of the Electoral College. And this is something that in the past has taken as little as a half hour to certify the votes submitted by each state. But something else may happen here. We're not sure what. Sarah, what happens if there are objections? What's the process as we approach January 6th for that day?
Well, first of all, there are some people that could bring forward objections, like the newly elected Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama had said, for example, he might. But this is going to be a tough bar because, first of all, you need a member from both the House and the Senate to lodge a complaint from that state. So you'd have to have, say, Grassley, and then one of the U.S. House members would have to jointly agree to raise an objection. Mm-hmm. And then the objection would have to be considered by both chambers. And in that case, both chambers would have to agree to the objection. So in that case, the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate would have to both vote in favor of the objection. And given that the Democrats control the House, that's just not obviously that these objections are not going to succeed through this process.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, if so far it seems like at least one member of the House will go along and or raise an objection, which historically, I guess, is not unusual. So far, I don't know if there's a senator nailed down will go along with this challenge. But in that case, then we go on to the next phase.
Well, we owe this. We possibly owe this all to the state of Alabama because, as Sarah said, there's Senator newly elected Tuberville, who took the seat from Doug Jones from Alabama, the Democrat who was there accidentally because of beating Roy Moore a couple of years ago, several years ago. But if Tuberville goes through with this, and he's got pressure from McConnell not to. But we'll see. His colleague Mo Brooks from Alabama presumably has said that he will lodge an objection. And there are a lot more radical Trump supporters in the House than there are in the Senate. So it's very possible this will occur. But, of course, this will be the new Senate. And we don't know the outcome of the Georgia election at this point. It would be, I guess, 50 Republicans to 48 Democrats, and the independents allied with the Democrats, pending the outcome of waiting for what happens in Georgia, which will be the 5th of January. But in any case, at most, the Republicans would have 52 votes in the Senate. But the interesting question is whether senators like, I'm very concerned, Susan Collins, or Lisa Murkowski, or Mitt Romney, or Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania is not going to run for re-election in 22. It's possible that some Republicans in the Senate, even leaving out McConnell. Hello, have I still got you?
Yes, Dennis, you're
okay,
there. You dropped for a minute. You're still with us.
Right, okay.
Go ahead.
You know, it's possible even some Republicans might want to the wrath of Trump and vote against the objection. But as Sarah said, if you get an objection in both chambers, at least one, they've got to go off by themselves. They have 2 hours maximum to make this decision. And Sarah quite rightly says the Democratic House is never going to support this. But, you know, the problem goes back to the fact that, as I said before on the program, the Republicans, or certainly the president and his supporters, have been operating according to a heads we win, tails you lose premise. That's false. But the premise is there is no way Democrats can win a fair and honest election. So therefore, the Republicans either win, or if it looks as though the Democrats have won, then by definition, the election was not fair and honest. So the president and his folks have tried to get the votes, prevent them from being certified. That failed. The electors actually cast their votes on the 14th. This is their last stab at this. And, you know, the Trump base likes the president more than particular policies. They say they like that he's a fighter. So if he wants to hold on to that base for whatever reasons he chooses after January 20th, he's got to appear to be a fighter going out. And I think that's what a lot of this is about.
I was interested in seeing a colorful quote by the senator from South Dakota, the Republican John Thune, on this matter. He gave his assessment of the likelihood of this going forward, the objections, telling reporters on Monday, it's just not going anywhere. It's going down like a shot dog. And apparently the president heard his fellow Republicans' remarks on yesterday evening, the president blasting Thune on Twitter, writing, South Dakota doesn't like weakness. He will be primaried in 2022. Political career over. So there, Dennis, you talked about the president's wrath exercising a threat there. This is exactly what has been going on the past few weeks, especially, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, even among Republicans who haven't been comfortable with what the president does, there hasn't been a lot of evidence of profiles and courage over the last 4 years. But as some states like the Dakotas or Wyoming are increasingly one-party states, and they're certainly one-party Democratic states, or as districts are one-party, you know, the 435 congressional districts, I think only about 41 or so in this last election were considered battlegrounds where either party had a chance to win. Most of them are not competitive, so your big political opponent is likely to come not in the general election because the other party doesn't have a real shot. It comes from within your own party, and that's a fear, as the verb has become now, of being primaried, and that's what the president's working with to put pressure on those he thinks are not supporting him sufficiently.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. If you've just joined us, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa. One last big slab of politics on our plate to address. Let's talk about this Russian hack here. President-elect Joe Biden already preparing to take office amid a worsening coronavirus pandemic, also the economy slumping. Now he'll have to deal with this major national security threat, an unprecedented hack on U.S. government agencies and private companies. Evidently, hackers spending months exploring numerous U.S. government networks, private companies, industry experts, government officials say Russia is responsible. Our Secretary of State Pompeo, the Attorney General Barr, have publicly attributed the hack to Russia. In his pre-holiday remarks yesterday, President-elect Joe Biden said the Trump administration took its eye off the ball on cybersecurity.
Enough's enough. In an age when so much of our lives are conducted online, cyber attacks must be treated as a serious threat by our leadership at the highest levels. We can't let this go unanswered. That means making clear and publicly who is responsible for the attack and taking meaningful steps to hold them in account. Initial indications, including from Secretary Pompeo, Secretary of State, and Attorney General William Barr, suggest that Russia is responsible for this breach. It certainly fits Russia's long history of reckless, disruptive cyber activities. But the Trump administration needs to make an official attribution. This assault happened on Donald Trump's watch when he wasn't watching. It's still his responsibility as president to defend American interests for the next 4 weeks. But rest assured that even if he does not take it seriously, I will.
President-elect Biden yesterday, President Trump has downplayed the severity of this hack, even saying it could be China. Sarah Mitchell, what do you see in the reactions to this unprecedented hack? And they're still discovering the extent of it. But something like this has not happened for quite a long time.
Yeah, I mean, this is the largest cybersecurity hack in the U.S. government ever. And so I feel like it should be getting a lot more attention than it is. So we don't even know yet, right, what the full extent of the compromise is in terms of what systems the hackers have gotten into. They hacked through a company that was providing cybersecurity protection to lots of different parts of our government. And so we don't really know what intelligence they have, how damaging it could be to the United States in the long run. But I think, you know, the intelligence agencies under the Trump administration put out reports showing that the Russians had had these hacking efforts in the previous election. And they just haven't been taken seriously, right, by Trump and his administration. And in fact, you know, he's pardoning some of the people that were involved, right, in some of that stuff in the election, previous election. So I don't have any reason to believe that Trump's going to do anything about this in the remaining days that he's in office. But I think from a national security perspective, we should be very concerned about, you know, what kind of, you know, military or other intelligence that these hackers have gotten control of, and how will this be used against U.S. troops or U.S. security interests abroad?
Yeah, right. Hacking the Department of Energy, the State Department, Department of Homeland Security, the entity that is there to protect us from cyber attacks, was itself evidently hacked, and it was undetected for months until a private security firm noticed the suspicious activity and alerted the National Security Agency. Dennis, your thoughts here and the reaction of the primary actors?
Well, you know, anytime something major, particularly a major danger, catastrophe occurs, people all across the country look to the president. And even, you know, if there's some sort of global economic catastrophe, I recall at one point on a, you know, when we run, we hear the BBC on IPR in the afternoon, people saying we're waiting to hear what the president says tonight. The British stockbrokers were wanting to know what the president said. So people around the world, at least in the past, at least up to this president, have looked to see what the president says about various issues. Now, certainly in this country, when you talk about the pandemic, and we really haven't had a comment of any prominence from the president about the death toll and all that, and the concern about that, and then this particular cyber attack, the president's been missing in action. In other words, it's as if somebody were worried about getting snow cleared or the grass mowed, but the house is burning and not paying attention to the house burning. So that's the problem. I mean, this is, as Sarah said, there's probably more here, and this is absolutely crucial because it affects certainly government, but evidently private industry, and does it affect our banks? Who knows, our credit cards and so forth? But his focus is completely elsewhere. And that's really the irony of all this that we talked about leading up to this with the president concerned about the election. You know, my impression is he doesn't really like being president. He wants to play one on TV, but he doesn't really like the job of being president. And he's just been missing in action, and certainly during the pandemic when he stopped showing up at the daily briefings. And with the cyber attack, this is even more immediately dangerous in a non-health kind of domain, and he's just not really there.
Mm-hmm. President-elect Biden. Yeah, go ahead, Sarah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, I think some positive signs here moving forward, though, are that President-elect Biden, you know, is obviously going to take this seriously, and I think going to follow through, you know, with so the 2021 National Defense Authorization Act has a provision that would create a Senate-confirmed national cyber director role. And I think that's, you know, a really good idea that will help coordinate federal cybersecurity efforts. But also the U.S. Navy just released its Tri-Services Maritime Strategy document. And in that, they talk about the importance of, you know, combating cybersecurity issues and addressing those, you know, for the Navy and the Coast Guard, mm-hmm. et cetera. The U.S. military is taking this seriously, and President-elect Biden and his team is taking this very seriously. So I think moving forward, we will have a response to this.
Yeah. The president-elect saying, in his words, the hackers will be held accountable, and he also vowed to impose financial repercussions on individuals as well as entities. Here, let's talk a little bit about what options the President-elect Biden, soon to be president, 28 days away from being president, may have, because we get into a gray area, don't we? Because traditional espionage is something that's been around for as long as there have been nation states, and even before that, right? But we know that crossing the line would be something like hacking into a power grid, turning off power in our country. This seems to be, so far, looking in all these very sensitive departments about what's going on, gathering intelligence. Dennis, what options does the president-elect have short of, I mean, I think I heard one quote, maybe you did too, that this is almost a declaration of war.
It's pretty serious. It's pretty darn serious. There's no question about that. Options, and again, I'm not a foreign policy specialist at all, so I defer to Sarah in that regard. But as president-elect, Mr. Biden doesn't have a lot he can do at this point. He can try to get prepared. But remember how the Trump administration is not liaising with these folks, not offering cooperation. What you'd normally have between an outgoing and an incoming administration, the folks below the cabinet level, certainly in the various agencies and departments and so forth, would they cooperate with their successors and try to bring them up to speed to know what's going on. And by the reports I've seen, that the Biden people are not getting this. So they'll have a lot of catch-up to do once they do get in there. But I'm not sure where we are with regard to sanctions, things like that. And, of course, we've had issues with the Russians for 4 years that the president, this current president, has denied. And so I'm, you know, in terms of what tools are in the toolkit to deal with this, and we certainly don't want to go to war over this. That'd be the end of civilization as we know it. I'm not sure what's there.
Okay, Sarah, let's draw upon your foreign policy expertise and ask you the same question. The options before the soon-to-be President Biden?
Well, I think economic sanctions are an obvious strategy and that have been used against Russia in the past. Congress, in fact, enacted some sanctions against Russia that Trump did not implement at various points in time. So Biden would obviously be willing to follow through with those. I think the government should treat this more like they treat state sponsors of terror. So that's one of the reasons, right, where we've had actions against Soleimani or other agents of Iran, for example, because we're punishing them for terrorist groups. So I think the problem is, like, cybersecurity and cyber hacking, it's like terrorism, right? It's often carried out by people that we don't know for sure who carried out the attack. We have ideas, but we can be harsher on how we treat the countries that we think are supporting those acts of cybersecurity hacks. And so I think, it's going to be hard to figure out, who exactly should be punished individually. But I think, like I said, the U.S. military is developing lots of different strategies for how to detect cybersecurity hacks and how to defend against them. And I think having private company, the one that provides this, this shows, right, that this is problematic because the Russians hacked through this private company. And so I think that's going to raise questions as well.
In the final minute or so of the program, very briefly, give us your concluding thoughts on the political year nearly at an end, 2020. Turnout soaring in the election, yet Democrats did worse than expected. The Democrats defeating Trump, failing to retake the Senate for now. We don't know for sure on that. Lost ground in the House and in state legislatures. Dennis, quickly, your takeaways for political year 2020.
Both parties have to reconsider who they are and what they stand for. The Democrats, in terms of being on the wrong side of that or only one side of that urban-rural split that's increasingly opening up. Republicans have got to figure out how to deal with the Trump phenomenon. Do they want to continue to be a wholly owned subsidiary, if you will, of the Trump organization, or do they want to reestablish who they are independently of Donald Trump?
Sarah, 30 seconds for you.
I mean, I think people need to get back to treating information like it's not partisan. I just see this with so many people that I know that, you know, we're all viewing what's happening in the United States through such partisan lenses, and it's hurting both parties, and it's damaging relationships between people and their families and their friend groups. And my hope is that we can move past this partisan environment.
Okay, that's a good wish that most of us can get behind for the new year. Sarah Mitchell, the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, Dennis Goldford, Professor of Politics at Drake University. Dennis and Sarah, thank you so much. Happy holidays and happy new year to you both.
Same to you. Thanks.
River to river. From Iowa Public Radio News, our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. She was in the producer chair today. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.